You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
I'm Alex Higley.
And I'm Lindsay Hunter.
And I'm a writer.
Bud. Welcome to I'm a Writer, But. Today we have Coco Picard. Coco Picard is a writer, cartoonist, and curator. She is the author of The Healing Circle, which is the winner of the Red Hen Press Women's Prose Prize, and of two graphic novels, Meowsers and The Chronicles of Fortune, which was nominated for a Dinky Award. Art criticism and comics have otherwise appeared under the name Caroline Picard in Art Forum, Hyper Allergic, The Paris Review, and Seven Stories Press, among others. She started the Green Lantern Press in 2005, earned her MFA from the School of the Art Institute, and was a Bookends Fellow at Stony Brook University. You can visit her online at cocopicard.com. Welcome, Coco.
Welcome.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me. It's very exciting to be here.
So excited to have you. We were just chatting about how we know each other from pre-motherhood back in the lit scene days of Chicago.
I feel like I think one of my introductions to the lit scene of Chicago was quickies at the Innertown Pub.
Thank you. Hell yeah, yeah. I know. And you were running the Green Lantern Press, which was so fancy. And yeah, and then like life happened, like we blinked and it's 10 years later. Here we are, back together.
Yeah, this is like where the theme song happens.
I'll try to like slot one in post-production. Yeah, so. I might send you some lyrics, but we'll just
worry
about that later. your new book is The Healing Circle. I absolutely loved it. I thought it was so funny and poignant and weird and great, and I can totally see why it won the Red Hen Press Women's Prose Award. And I want to hear you read to us from it.
Thanks so much. All right, I'm gonna it's composed of a number of short chapters, so I'm just gonna read a few, and then I guess the only thing to know is that it's about a woman who sort of runs away from her family in search of a miracle cure. And all of her kids are old, and her husband had passed away, but she's sort of dislocated and kind of re-experiencing her life in the present tense. Okay, so here we go. The handlers tell everyone not to touch the Holy One. It's like strippers, Lena jokes. You can be touched, but not touch. Mother and the rest of the healing circle stand in line with a few hundred others in a long since closed Ross Dress for Less. Everyone shuffles forward to see the guru, and there she is, a stout woman sitting cross-legged on several silk tasseled pillows like a voluptuous chicken. The Holy One pulls Mother's head to her breast automatically, and already Mother is crying like a lamb with hiccups, pressing into her holiness's chest. Ma, 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 the guru says mechanically. Ma, 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 bleeding with a fuller voice. Everything is warm, a little too much. Mother stares at the fleshy linoleum tile and notices the faded silhouettes of former shopping aisles. She used to come here to find shoes. Ma, 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 surrounding members of the crowd shift and sway. Mother feels the pressure of the Holy One's arms, the pliancy of her skin. The guru smells like sweat, sugar, a hint of tiger balm and incense. Mother sobs. How can I live? How can I survive? What am I surviving? My mother never loved me, mother says. She is just about to let go of everything, all the tension, sorrow, resentment, to find redemption or solace or whatever, to have one of those moments when she might experience her unburdened, light-soaked, profound, true self and be healed. When a handler abruptly picks up mother by the shoulders and moves her to the side, setting her against Nancy's back, her mother slumps into weeping. It is Lena's turn to be touched. Mother turns to see Ma, Ma, Ma. Andrea's behind Lena, glowing with expectation, and mother turns. Devotees whisper beside her. The Holy One was beaten as a child, did you know? It's on her website. Nobody understood her gifts. Women always pay the price, someone else agrees. Mother might go back to the beginning of the line and do it all over again.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
That's all you're going to give us?
I can read like two more, but they're pretty, if you want, it's up to you.
Yeah? I think yes.
Okay. So this is another kind of episode from mother's sort of search for healing. That she, you know, visits all these places with her friends that call themselves the healing circle. But why do I get sick? Mother asks the room. She sits beside Lena and Nancy in the Marriott banquet hall of some suburb she'd been approximate to for years, but never heard of. Lena holds mother's hand. There are so many gurus out there, Lena whispers. If this one doesn't work, we'll find another. She finds these people through various self-help newsletters and blogs that have transformed her Google algorithms. I was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma several years ago. I'm in my sixth remission, mother says. Others in the room applaud like it's an AA meeting. And I'm trying to learn more about why this happens in order to prevent it from happening again. Mother worries she isn't making sense. Does that make sense? I want to survive. What can I do to live a better life? A guru is in the front of the room on a makeshift stage. This one is male and allegedly a prince from some very cold country in the Far East. He sits cross-legged, watching everyone and everything, eyes half-lidded. When he moves, he does so slowly, as though to demonstrate that he inhabits an alternate plane of reality. Rumor has it he is a difficult person. Lena says the hotel staff had trouble constructing the stage according to his specifications because their lowest risers were 12 inches, and he requires a stage no more than 7 inches in height for fear of reinscribing hierarchical patterns in his lifetime. The workshop was nearly canceled until the hotel carpenter cut 5 inches off each riser. These are the mysteries of the universe, the guru says. Why do we suffer? I know monks who feed stray dogs around the temple because they believe the dogs were bad monks in a past life. When you see a worm, what do you see? I see a being who fell from the karmic ladder. I do not know what the worm did, but I practice compassion. Everyone has weaknesses. Our weaknesses are failures and circumstances are teachings. But those same weaknesses, failures, circumstances further present opportunities. What shall we do within the constraints of our private theater of suffering, suffering even when it appears mindless, cruel. These fortunes enwrapped us, absorb us, fulfill an idea of ourselves, creating bundles of attachment. People applaud. Does that mean it's my fault? Mother whispers. And then I'll just read one last vignette. And this one is sort of written from the fictive present where mother is in the hospital room, and she, over the course of the book, befriends this aloe plant that eventually reveals itself to be called Madame Blavatsky. Outside the wellness center, a fine rain makes the woods especially dark and looming. Only a few patches of snow remain in the shadows, and the sky is swollen like a bruise. The television broadcasts a cooking show on mute. Mother changes the channel to find news pundits discussing an American porn star who allegedly slept with the president on multiple occasions. The aloe plant, always so bright, has dropped one of its arms. Why did you drop it? Mother wonders. What was wrong with that one? It looked just like the others, plump and green as malachite with almost purple spots. It seems a shame to let such a nice portion of oneself go to waste. Aloe contains such healing properties, she thinks. Maybe the arm is a gift. Or did the plant send its limb on an expedition to see what lies on the other side of its pot? That's the end. Or that's all I'll read at the end of the book.
Thank you, Coco.
Yeah.
One aspect of this novel that I really appreciated was the central predicament of the entire novel and, you know, of Mother herself can be summarized really simply and is on the back cover of this book. And yet, as soon as you begin reading, that predicament, which can be, you know, very concisely summarized, is complicated immediately by the structure and is given more texture and life immediately by how this book is organized. I was wondering if the structure of the Healing Circle is something that you started with, or if you had kind of the central predicament and then worked your way to a point where you knew how to tell the story.
Oh, I love that question, but I also love, that that's your experience of the book. I think that's what I was hoping. You know, in other words, that like it is sort of straightforward, but that the structure or the formal quality kind of makes it, I don't know, have texture or depth. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that I knew, I guess I should say I've been working on the book for a really, really long time, but also not in a kind of like a straightforward manner. And I think I knew early on, or just the way that it was happening, the way the book was happening, it was happening in these short vignettes. And so then I sort of wondered why, as I was working on it. And I think as I was working on it, I started to get really interested in this idea that, like, what if time in the book is sort of all happening at the same time to the main character, to the mother character. Mm-hmm. And how that, for me, on the one hand, like one of the things that she sort of asks herself periodically is if she's already died.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's like inhabiting a kind of purgatory, or whether this is like, you know, real linear life. And I guess I was excited that the creating these like formal constraints of like short chapters, all in the present tense, but also like representing different times of the mother's life, would kind of create this, hopefully this kind of like instant, this feeling of like, you know, everything is happening at once.
Mm.
How long have you been working on the book?
I mean, I think that I started working on this like in grad school, like 10, wow. 10 years ago or something. But I also think I kept sort of picking it up and putting it down and picking it, you know, because mm-hmm. it like was never working.
it strikes me like one of the big realizations I've had as a mom is that your everything is happening all at once, because your childhood is happening as you're experiencing your children's childhood and your young adulthood, and you're now always extremely in the present, you're excruciatingly in the present with your children, but your past is always right there, and you're always thinking about the future, and it really does feel like time is happening all at the same time, the way that it's happening for the mother in this book. Mm-hmm. And so it's so interesting, because I assumed you had written this once you became a mother, because it was like, ah, yes, she's had the same realization. Mm-hmm. Did it change for you? Like, did writing it change for you after you had kids? And I know that's such a usually a gendered question, but I really am specifically concerned with like the crafting of it and the, you know, where you were as you wrote it and how, you know, the story opened itself up to you in a different way, if possible.
Yeah, I think it totally did. I mean, I think also because I feel like I'd been sort of working on it, picking it up and putting it down for a number of years. And I kind of like got it to this point where it felt like it was it finally got to be itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like right at the point where it won, like I both got into the Stony Book Bookends Fellowship and it won the Red Hen Press Prose Prize. And so all of us, and there was COVID and I was like pregnant again.
Oh,
so I feel like it was like this really like that was the moment. I basically spent the next like, I don't know, year and a half just working on it. I mean, primarily, you know, of course there's like other things, like freelance work and whatever, working from home, childcare, that sort of stuff. But I feel like my creative focus at the time was suddenly and consistently just working on this book. And so I also think that really changed. Like, it's sort of like, I couldn't actually do that until the book was a sort of completed manuscript. But then there was all this other work to do to kind of like, for instance, again, like one of the formal things that I kept running up against was how do you have a book with these like composed of all these fragments that jump through different timelines all like throughout the book, but also keep the reader located in mm-hmm. each of those jumps, because that felt really important to me. And so I think that was like one of the big challenges that I worked on. And what was great was while I was working on that challenge, I feel like there were all of these other narrative discoveries that I made, you know, about like the mother character's backstory and what her kids were actually up to. And, you know, most of that stuff has also been cut, but I like know it's there.
Mm-hmm. No, I love George's trajectory is so I mean is so of the moment. And very, very interesting. And no, I love these little glimpses we get of like Bunny possibly broke her feet and, you know, is maybe in rehab or just out of rehab or no, she's fine, you know. It's like,
yeah.
And it brings me to another question I had, which is, her name is Ursula. The mother's name is Ursula or Sula,
mm-hmm.
But most of the time it's the mother. Mm-hmm. And even when she's flashing back to moments with her own mother, she's still thinking of herself as mother. And mm-hmm. I really wanted to hear you talk about that choice, because in some moments I thought, okay, that's how she sees herself, or that's sort of a way that like all of us start to see ourselves, because of, I don't know, man, society. But also it felt maybe even a little like a little bit of like an anger response toward her children, because that's how they treat her.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's also something she's proud of. And so I wanted mm-hmm. to hear what you were thinking when you named this character Mother, the Mother, all throughout the book.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was like, there's also, I guess I was really interested in how much, what do I want to say? It's like gravity. There's so, like, you sort of apply that name and all of a sudden she has this, what do you say? Like, I want to say centripetal force, but I don't know if that's right. But basically it's like something about who she is or what she represents in the book itself really changes in a way that I'm interested in. And mm-hmm. I think part of it, I'm interested in it because I think it's problematic. Like, I think it's, and this is again, just from some of the things that I was thinking about, I think it's really interesting that there's this idea that she's leaving her family. She's like abandoning her children, but her children are also fully grown and it's like not clear that she has much of her own life necessarily, like that she doesn't have a lot of obligations in her own life. So on the one hand, I feel like it seems like she's making a selfish decision. And I definitely think that she's, you know, she's like a complicated character. I don't think that she's like, any sort of saint. I think she is pretty selfish in a lot of ways, but I also think one of the reactions that I have had to her is like, I can't believe you would do this. And, you know, it's sort of like mirrored in what her kids say. I can't believe you would do this and like run off to get this cure. But also then there's a part of me that's like, yeah, but if I didn't call, like, if she wasn't called mother, if she was right. called, like, I wish I knew, I could remember what, you know, like the Eat, Pray, Love protagonist's name is, but if you sort of like gave her, I don't know, if she was just called Sula the whole time, then it would be much more just about like her journey as mm-hmm. like an individual. And so there was something that I was like interested in how calling her mother torques that, like how we expect her to behave. And then also there's this way where, I mean, I think I'm also kind of interested in the idea that she, within the world of this book, she is a mother, the mother. And then there are these like other mothers that kind of show up at different times.
Mm-hmm. There's a staginess to being called mother as opposed to, oh, she's my mother. Or like when it actually becomes a name and functions in that way, I feel like the nature of the fall or the nature of the leaving takes on a more complicated or just inscrutable quality immediately, as opposed to mom or
mama
or, you know, or Ursula or Sula. And yeah, there, I think it gives immediately, it just adds a little bit of strangeness to it. It adds an extra tension immediately because you're kind of reading to interpret how to understand that naming. It is wild how much baggage it holds, just that name. I mean,
I know, I'm realizing
it's unbelievable. Like I never hear it like flatly, like I think like mother or like, you know, like it's like never, like it's never just mother. It's there's always something that the reader is bringing to it heavily.
I'm realizing that as I pictured her, I would always picture her in like lotus pose, like floating with like light coming from her forehead because of the mother. But it goes to she's in denial, and I think that's sort of like a necessity when you're that sick. You mm-hmm. have to just, if you're, you know, and I think part of her leaving her family is like, don't worry. Like, yeah, this sucks, but I'm going to go get better. And then I'm going to come back and I'm going to be your mother. Mm-hmm. And there's this just heartbreaking denial happening there. And like every once in a while, you know, like the truth or reality sort of like creeps in. But for the most part, she's like, yeah, I can't feel my legs, but you know, like this,
yeah,
I'm going to be the first one to be cured and it's going to be great, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think that was like another thing that I was also really interested in was this, like where is her ego, you know, where's her ego in this? And then what is the relationship between like her ego and like, again, that name? Like, I feel like there's also a way where she's like, entire aside from being sick and like grappling with this disease for many, many years, she's like, this is a scenario like entirely of her own making, so she's kind of responsible for it.
Mm-hmm.
In another way that I feel like is like, for better or worse, often attributed to mothers, you know. And I think that then there's something really wild about this idea, which I feel like, I don't know, it's easy to fall prey to in different ways or different manifestations and constructs or something. But I feel like she is telling herself that she's going to go to this place, you know, this like German wellness center, and she's going to get this cure, and then she's going to be healed, and then she will revolutionize, like just change the history and face of medicine forever. Yeah. For everybody. Yeah. Which is also like kind of a saint complex type of thing, I think.
Yeah, I'm gonna go do this insane thing. It doesn't make any sense to anyone. It's dangerous. I shouldn't do any of this. It's expensive. But just you wait, you know. You'll and see. It's also like the way that it's sort of dropped into conversation, which all of their gurus and healing stuff is, you know, her and her group of friends, the healing circle. It's like, oh yeah, I heard so-and-so went to Germany and this happened. And that becomes the thing that's going to change it all for her. But I also deeply relate, you know, it's like, I'll do whatever, you know, if I have the resources, sure. I don't care. I'll drink my own pee, you know, like whatever. I don't know, but I'll do it. Because, you know, there's like such a poignance to like the base desire to just keep living.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also there's something about like, what would the alternative be? And it seems like the alternative in this instance would be for like, for mother to sit still and like be in one place and acknowledge that she's dying sort of publicly. I mean, publicly meaning like in front of her family and her friends.
Yep.
And this is like, by going this route, she sort of is like, no, we're not. I'm not doing that.
You know what I mean? She's like, la, 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 it's fine.
Yeah.
Everyone's fine. I'm fine. Mm-hmm. I really want to talk about how you, the very first page of the book, chapter one.
I was going to ask about that too. Yeah.
In fact, could you just read it to us? Cause it's only, it's very short.
Yeah. Of course. Okay. It is just past twilight. A young woman enters the frame of a bleak late winter wood, looking directionless and distracted. She stops to look at the sky. It isn't raining, but the ground is wet with rotting leaves and pine needles and dripping snow. Judging by the cuff of her jeans, she has been walking for some time. It is likely her socks are wet. She trips on a root, winding between black tree trunks, hands dug deep in a bright green coat. She approaches a tall man in an undershirt and plastic perforated clogs. He seems out of place, underdressed and ill-prepared, carrying a catheter like a purse. The strangers nod at one another before carrying on in opposite directions. The woman bisects a helipad. Its concrete is a buckling mess of negligence. And behind her, the man throws his catheter in the air without apparent effort. The bag of urine transforms into a parrot, flies off above the trees, and disappears behind the edge of the window. Gods appear in such strange places, Mother thinks, before turning away from the window and drifting off to sleep.
Please say more about that. It's so striking. Continue.
I will say, I think that is like one of the only things that's remained more or less intact from the first draft.
Wow.
It's something that I feel like I kept, I would go get into places and like cut it or move it and it would just sort of always find its way back to the very beginning. But I think, I was thinking, Alex, about what you said in terms of the staginess of like calling mother. Mm. And I also feel like I don't know if this is your all's impression, but, definitely when I finished the book, I was like, wow, I do feel like it has this like a staged quality, like mm-hmm. everything more or less happens in one room, except that a lot of the action happens in Mother's imagination or in her memory. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the way it sort of happens live seems like, you know, I could imagine it like the hospital room goes dim and then you see these like actors yes. appear. Of course it would be like very cheesy, but like, so in other words, I was thinking about that comment in relation to this opening, because I feel like the frame of the window is so important mm-hmm. to me. And the fact that like, there's this sort of magical transformation that happens, but then you're immediately aware of this kind of a limited sight line mm-hmm. and instantly, hopefully, the sort of instability of mother's frame of reference and whether or not like she's experienced, like what she's seeing is true, or she's just like highly, you know, on all these weird drugs that.
Right.
Even as you went back and read it, it struck me that the opening really does have it almost reads like a play. You know, we're opening, it's twilight, a young woman enters the frame, could easily be, you know, someone coming on stage. And even the kind of there's a kind of like silhouetted quality to the way the human characters appear in that first little section. Just the fact that it's like, it's so, they're like presented very starkly, and the details are not ones that link them together, but separate them. Like, you know, a man holding a catheter, like a purse. Okay. He's off over here. Right. We got that. And then we have a woman, you know, walking in this very, you know, interesting forest type landscape. But there's a kind of like loneliness to the way they're presented as well, where I feel like it's such a great place to start because it imbues everything that follows with I think a lot of what the book needs to succeed. In that if you opened with in a different spot, a less dramatic spot almost, it really does change so much. I feel like it's such a wonderful frame for the novel. Did you always have it up front to start?
Yeah, I think so. But then I would like, you know, I don't know. Maybe this happens to you too. I feel like I've been so lucky to have different friends and colleagues like read versions of the draft along the way. And I think it was always like, who is this girl? And like, what's up with the parrot? You know what I mean? And so I feel like those were things where I would try and like answer those questions. And my attempts, you know, like directly, like to basically like, maybe the girl is, you know, a nurse or, you know, essentially to try and make these first characters or people that we see have like later consequence. And I feel like I was never able to answer, like any of my attempts were just always failed. And so then I would try and just, I think like, oh, I have to get rid of that. And then it wouldn't feel right.
Right. I feel like so often, sometimes a daring opening like that, or, you know, whatever it may be, this isn't always the case, but I feel like presented with certain choices in a Word doc, it's never going to work. And then when you see it in a book, it feels like the instinct is kind of like ratified. It's like, yeah, oh, okay.
I think it's important for things to remain unexplained, because that's like the true beauty of living. It's for these mysteries to endure, you know? And like, especially thinking about how the book ends with Madame Blavatsky, and, you know, everything Madame Blavatsky stands for and reaching out for the mother. And we get these sensory details that the mother shouldn't have about the woman going through the forest. And so it almost makes me feel like there's a different transformation or perspective wedging itself in. And it's not something that like the mother ever expected, but is exactly what she was looking for somehow. So I love that there are these things that happen that don't ever make sense in your, you know, like in our human experience. We've never seen a catheter bag turn into a parrot and fly off, and, you know, it doesn't make sense for people to walk past each other and not be like, hey, why are you standing out here with your catheter bag, you know? But
are you lost?
Right, exactly. Can I help you? But it makes sense in the like the this other world that the mother is like trying to settle into and doesn't even know that she is, you know, like it makes sense there. It's like a travel, you know, it's a travel, like this is basketball. It's like a journey. It's a travel.
I mean, that's like, because I sometimes I also feel like over the course of writing something like this, like often my direct attempts to solve a like quote unquote problem, or, you know, maybe let's just say like it's like a stumbling block that readers bump into and sort of are like, what's up with that? Sometimes I feel like my most direct attempts don't fix or resolve the issue, but there's like the ways in which those direct attempts sort of accumulate. There's like a residual accumulation that kind of like buffs out the issue, you know, in other words. So like, I couldn't figure out who these characters were, like the perforated clog dude, because he's just a patient maybe, and this like stranger who's walking through the woods. But then I think maybe having to tackle who they were made me like change or adjust the book overall in these more nuanced ways. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. I think like the human brain really likes to puzzle things out, and that's part of the joy of being a reader anyway, is kind of slotting in like the clues you've picked up, or, you know, things that matter to you, and kind of painting a picture that is very meaningful and like specialized for yourself. And I don't know, I'm in awe of writers that are able to do that, to leave that like space for the reader the way that you did with this one little page.
There is a logic, a real logic to it though as well, because it's like the chapters, many of the chapters are so short that even just an, you know, not that you ever need an answer, but if you were forced to just say something like, well, I mean, it gives the opening a tonal quality that I needed to have the rest work. Mm-hmm. It's like, that's enough because the chapters are so short. I feel like, you know what I mean? I mean, seriously, it's like, if that was a 10 page opening and none of it connected back in a way that was directly obvious to a reader paying attention, that's one thing. But if it's barely a page and it's giving us this incredible atmosphere and mood to get us into the main narrative, that's completely a valid choice in my mind.
Yeah. And also, like, one of the main things it does is establish the book's sense of humor, which is all throughout the book. And you know, like, Mother just is like, huh, you know, God's appear. Anyway, nine, you know, it's, the book is so, I posted like a screenshot of like one of the shortest chapters on my social media, and I can't remember what it says, but it's basically like, oh, everyone agrees that this guru's on a power trip, so we all decided to drop LSD at, oh, the ayahuasca group leader up north is on a power trip, so the healing circle cancels their weekend trip and decides to watch movies and microdose LSD at Lena's house instead. This is what it must feel like to be an American teenager, Mother thinks, pleased to check it off her bucket list. It is so funny. It is just genuinely funny and hilarious. And I feel like we've spent like the first 30 minutes of this podcast talking about like its mystical qualities, but it is hilarious. How, you know, like, was the humor always there? Did it surprise you that it was going to be so funny?
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. I think the whole, well, I mean, yeah, I don't know. Yes and no. Like, I think it was, I needed it. I always needed it, but also because it was like, these were things that really seem funny to me. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah. Like, of course there's something, what do I want to say? Like, I relate to the terror of like, want of like self-improvement, the desire for constant self-improvement of whatever form. But also it's like really funny, like the lengths that, I mean, and maybe I shouldn't speak for everybody, but like the lengths that I go to, or the lengths that I've, you know, seen friends or family members go to like try and achieve this thing. Like, on the one hand, you're like, oh yeah, snake oil, whatever. And then all of a sudden, like, I'm like, oh, but maybe I do want to try this like weird vitamin thing, you know, right. Like I mean, I think this one is really funny. The like face marble roller. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you're like, oh yeah, that feels kind of good. And I guess this is like gonna, I never really cared about wrinkles, I thought, but then this thing is like, you might get wrinkles. And I'm like, so I can just roll this on my face and I'm gonna feel better. Oh, why not? I'll just spend like $30 on this dumb thing, you know.
Yep, I freeze it every night.
And
someone gave me a gift certificate for which was like $155 for someone to shave all the peach fuzz off my face.
What?
And I was like, is this an issue? Should I not have peach fuzz on my face?
Why is it so expensive?
It is so expensive. I was like, can I trade this in for a pedicure?
And you're like,
yeah, wait. Yeah, wait.
And then I'm going to be freaking swarthy after that.
Can we focus on this? $155 to shave your face one time?
It's like some procedure. I don't remember what it's called. But yeah, it was $155 to go get all the peach fuzz. And this person was like, it'll make your face as smooth as a baby's. And I was like, no, I'm not doing
that. I don't even get that. That doesn't make
sense. I'm going to have to shave every other day.
God. Or like that also, I mean, I'm really into it, but I've never done it actually. Just like the idea, but it's like the spa treatment where you can go and you put your feet in like a fish tank and the fish just like eat your feet. And it's like,
people get bacterial infections from that.
Of course they do.
But it does, you do think to yourself, like, oh, duh, we could have been doing this all along. We just haven't been doing this. And now if we'll do this, then, you know, like I won't get like a hairy upper lip when I turn 40, you know, like I'm so stupid. I should have been whatever. I should have doing hyaluronic acid should have been in my cereal at age 6 and I wouldn't be so wrinkly now, you know, it's just like, it's constant. It makes sense. You know, like we're always striving, but it's hilarious and it's heartbreaking.
Well, and I guess I feel like it's like one of those things where I think on the one hand, I mean, I think on the one hand, it was like, it felt important to, like, I guess I hope that one of the lasting impressions of the book, first and foremost, is that it is funny, because I think it's a pretty, like, otherwise it's kind of monotonous, or I think it could very easily be a very like a monotonous meditation on like what it is to die, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But I also think like that balance I think is really important and is in life all the time too, where you're like, oh wow, life is so depressing, but it's hilarious, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's something really funny about how like, so what if all of these cures that you kind of are very seductive or actually just because you don't want to think about how you're dying or mortal or getting old or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then I think it's funny that like, on the one hand, there are all these gurus in the book who like, even some of them, you know, they have like interesting things to say sometimes, but they're all kind of like supposedly helping people negotiate mortality, except it's just a business. Do you know what I mean? It's like, mm-hmm. they're still just getting lots of people to pay a lot of money to get a hug or whatever, you know?
Yep. I feel like I could be a really good grifter if I just had like a slight less of a conscience. Like, I'd be like, I could be rich, but I would feel too guilty.
I mean, I kind of like, yeah, I really, similarly, it makes me wonder, I don't know. Like, I feel like there should, do they go to the same parties, these gurus? And like, do some of the gurus are like, oh, did you see like so-and-so? She's a real phony. But like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm always interested if, to what extent do people believe in themselves? And I mean that as in a real question. And I don't mean that necessarily because I think all gurus are lying. Like, I do think that there's a lot of, it's like a very gray area for me, but I'm interested in it. And then I'm also really interested in how much people believe in what they're selling.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that not everybody does. Like, I think some people are total phonies. They like know that they're phonies. And then I think there are other people who like believe it. And what's that like? And what kind of conversations do they have in their like, you know, they're like guru Slack channel?
Yeah, I watched that Under the Banner of Heaven, based on that book, Under the Banner of Heaven. And there's a bunch about, and I don't remember the book at all for some reason, but there's a bunch about Joseph Smith and like the start of Mormonism. And I think there's a constant question all throughout that's like, does this dude believe that he saw this angel, or was he like saying that because he was horny for who eventually married him, you know? And like, and it is, it's like you really do like kind of squint and look and think like, I guess I can forgive him a little bit if he truly believes this, but then why would he truly believe, you know? Like it's a fine line.
Yeah. And like, I mean, I think there's also so much, I don't know, like there's just different degrees of that. Like, I feel like it shows up in, I have a family member who like got a job at like a new tech company that was like, there was just a lot of like language, like company language that was like right on the edge of like self-help, you know, like this company is going to save the planet. It's going to save your life, like buy into it. We're going to do it together, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's also amazing because I think it doesn't necessarily have to be like in a religious capacity, you know?
Oh no, I think it's every job. I mean, literally every single job that you can have, there's some kind of like reckoning with they may not phrase it to themselves as morality, but there is some kind of built-in justification for the existence of the job and the way the money is being made within the language of the company, like you're saying, even if it's less obvious than some kind of do-gooding tech company. It's like, it doesn't matter if it's a grocery store, garbage pickup, it could be anything. It's just like they all, I think even if people have the initial self-awareness or kind of like organizational awareness that maybe there is a wrongdoing being done, there's immediately this like the secondary move of, well, we can justify it for X. And even if it's not something that's like a total buy-in by everybody, I think this is like, it's completely relevant to all ways of living and making money and everything.
Yeah. I think especially these days, like it's not enough to be like, you know, you want to be successful, don't you? Like you want the big, you know, the nice house and to like whatever it, cause people are kind of onto that, you know, these days. So it has to kind of be like, you're going to change the world. And, you know, like your contribution matters, you know, because it's like a lot of us are like, yeah, you don't pay me enough, you know, like to care this much. Mm-hmm. But maybe you can get me on, we're going to take the plastic out of the oceans somehow by making this new app, whatever. Mm-hmm. What would you say, Coco, if I said this was a sneaky novel about immigration and migration?
I mean, I think that that's, I would agree with that. Mm-hmm.
It's in there, people.
Yeah, I feel like one of the things that I was also really interested in was this idea of, like, I feel like mother's identity is very complex. Like, she was born in Argentina, but her parents left Germany shortly after the war, and you know, I think that they decided to settle in this place, in this town called La Cumbrecita, which was founded by Germans. And so there's this kind of colonial aspect of like Ursula's upbringing that I think is kind of interesting. In other words, like, I think her father in particular is not a good dude. He likes it there because he can kind of pretend that the war never happened. Mm-hmm. And then this is like a lot of backstory that it's in the book. So I don't know if it's good to like talk about it all, but basically like in some ways, the fact that then like Ursula and the mother character and her brother and mother, they leave the father and immigrate to New York or to the United States. And sort of this starts to unfold in the book in mother's memory at the same time as there are more and more refugees that start coming into the hospital and like sleeping in the corridors because they don't have anywhere to be. And so there's this kind of additional dislocation in what the space of the wellness center becomes and mother's sort of place, like her entitlement in relation to them. Mm-hmm. I think all of that stuff was really important and interesting to me. I think especially juxtaposed with this idea of like wellness and health and self-care and who, I guess, like the even the privilege of deciding like where you're going to die.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's, I think that that's not a direct conscious thought in the mother character's mind, but I also think that it is what is happening.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it's on the news, it's all over the place.
Mm-hmm. There's a way where the hopefully the ways in which the world also appears and it is like transmitting into the book, like through the television or through the arrival of strangers, that you really get the sense that it's like kind of it's falling apart in all of these different ways at the same time.
No getting around it, just like there's no getting around death. Yet, I should say yet. Well, we want to thank you so much for coming on. I loved your book so much. I think yes. I convinced at least one person to buy it on when I posted about it. And I hope I'm convincing more via this episode because it is such a delight and something I've been thinking about a lot ever since I finished reading it. So everyone go to Red Hen Press and pick up a copy of The Healing Circle by Coco Picard.
There you go.
Thanks so very much, everyone.
That was great.
That was great.
Love that book.
Good book. Good weird book.
Good weird book. Yes. Great synopsis.
Thank you.
I just have a couple things. Do you have anything?
I have one question for you.
Please.
What is your favorite Halloween candy?
Oh my God.
Provided that it is not coming in its full size. You are getting
okay.
The Halloween snack size. Yeah.
Okay. All right. I feel this answer has definitely changed over my life span.
Okay.
So if I'm a kid, I'm going with Smarties.
Really?
I still love Smarties.
I do too. So I like them just like as a little pick me up. Just like yes. Yeah, a little Smarties. Yeah.
Anyone hands you a Smartie and you're like, oh my God.
Yeah. It's great.
How great. Mm-hmm. But now as an adult, and you know, my husband and I both have reached a point in our lives where like we can't eat the crappy Halloween candy anymore.
Okay.
But if gun to my head, it's going to be Milky Way Dark.
Great, great answer.
They're rare.
Amazing answer.
What's yours?
You know what? Okay. I've thought about this a lot. I have a reasoning here. My answer is Snickers. And here's why. It is not the sexy pick, but 2 months down the line, if I'm just like in that cupboard and I find the little Snickers, I'm thrilled.
You're delighted. Okay.
Absolutely. Like full-size Snickers, small Snickers. It's great because it's what I want.
That's
it
delivers. Ben's favorite too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just a classic.
What about peanut butter Snickers?
Never had one.
Oh.
Didn't even know they existed.
Peanut butter is like my favorite food, I think.
You do love peanut butter. I love peanut butter too, but possibly less than you.
You know, I think what it is I'm a vegetarian and I eat zero protein. And so my body's like, please. And so I just love, I just love peanut butter because it's protein.
Sure.
Okay. Great question. I feel like more people should give out score bars and Rolos.
Oh, Rolos are great.
You just never see those anymore.
Love a Rolo. Love a Rolo.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
I'll do a Butterfinger. Like a Butterfinger to me is amazing. Like, but you just have to like acknowledge that you're about to like fuck up your teeth. And then like, I actually like need to go handle it after. It's like,
it's a little snack for later. Stuck in your molar.
I hate that shit. I'll go floss immediately.
I've unfortunately reached the point in my life where like I forget that I've just eaten something like right before school pickup, and I'll go and I'll talk to all the moms and be smiling and everything, and I'll get back in the car and I'll have like a giant something in my teeth.
Sure.
And I feel like I used to see my mom do that, and I'd be like, get it together. Now I'm like, oh God, that's me.
I think it's fine.
Thank you.
I think it's good.
I am very forgiving when I see people have something in their teeth. I'm not like horrified or anything.
That doesn't really bother me. Yeah.
Close to them as a human when it happens.
I'm not really bothered by physical appearance mistakes because I make them constantly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whatever.
I was on the, I rode a school bus the other day because I chaperoned my son's field trip. And one of the moms who I'm friends with sat with me on the way back. And there was like this intermittent fart smell.
Oh, hell yeah.
And in that moment, you can't be like, do you smell that? Because
she's
what if she's farting? Mm-hmm. I don't think she was. But then I started thinking, what if she thinks I'm farting?
And then did you consider that you were?
I wasn't. I'm pretty aware.
But did you consider that maybe you were and you weren't aware?
I did. That thought did cross my mind. And I thought like, oh my God, is my body getting away from me?
Do I no longer have control of that?
Listen, it didn't smell like my farts. Okay. So sure, like I'm pretty familiar with that. Anyway, I just didn't know how to resolve it. I just ignored it. And I could see her actively ignoring it. But I want her to know it wasn't me. But if it was her, it's fine.
Well, she's definitely not listening. So
No, she's absolutely not listening. And if she did listen, she would laugh. But you can't be like, just so you know, that's not me farting if they're farting. Because then she'll be like,
I think you can.
If I was a little bit closer to her, I would definitely acknowledge it, but
yeah,
we're not on the fart level yet. How fast did you and Britt start farting in front of each other?
Oh boy. Quick.
Yeah. Same.
Yep. We have like, I mean, having talked to other married couples, we're very near the bottom as far as boundaries. Like there's no boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, yeah. I think it comes with kids though. I think that there's a big difference between, it's just like, I don't know. Like, it's craziness all the time. Whatever.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's, I love feeling completely accepted in all my everything, except like we don't like poop in front of each other, but that's about it. Everything else wide open.
Yeah. There's no boundaries.
Although he does like, he'll be like, hi, honey, from the bathroom. Okay.
It also depends on orientation of house. I got to say.
Yes.
Sometimes it's just like, you're just there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, we had a pocket door put in when we had our upstairs bathroom rehabbed a few years ago. And it has four glass panels, which is an idiotic bathroom door. And so like our guy like quickly put like stick on window decals or whatever to make it like frosted window look. Mm-hmm. Two of them have peeled off because it's a freaking bathroom and it gets steamy in there. So you can just see anyone doing anything in there at any time. What are you going to do? We're a family.
Yeah, whatever.
I watched Barbarian last night, which is
I am hearing about this movie fucking constantly.
It's maybe the best horror film I've seen in years.
Wow. Okay.
I say go into it not knowing anything.
I know a little bit.
Don't watch the trailer. Don't
trust me. I didn't.
I don't know if you're going to like it because you hate scary movies.
I mean,
right?
Listen, it's going to scare the shit out of me. Just looking at the poster, I was like, I don't know if I can handle this.
You don't even know, man. The poster does not tell you anything.
That's what I'm saying.
It is.
I'm going to get wrecked by this movie.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Are all the best horror films also a little bit sad?
Wow, I love that question. I mean, how could the answer not be yes?
I'm thinking of like,
has to be yes.
I thought the Babadook was really sad.
Never seen it. I haven't seen anything.
I think Shining's sad.
Shining's definitely sad. That's one of my favorite movies, though. Shining is one of my five favorite movies.
Did you see Room 237?
Of course.
Okay. I love that so much.
I've seen The Shining like legitimately 40 times.
Mm-hmm. It's great.
I would watch it with my sister every time it snowed when we were kids.
Oh my God.
I feel like, yeah, I don't know. And growing up in Colorado, it felt like,
yes.
I don't know. It just felt like our movie. It felt like a special movie with my sister, which is, you know, of course the kind of movie you want to put on and just have good memories with your sister.
It's really a comforting film.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is like, kind of nice though, as kids to be like, wow, parents can be real shitheads. God. And it's, It's good that we know that, you know?
It really is. That movie has everything. I'm not even like Room 237 was super fun to watch because I love the movie, but like, I don't even give a shit about any of that. Like,
no.
Literally, I don't care if any of that is true, if it's all true, I don't give a shit. Like, just even on the most base level, I just love the movie. It's just a great movie. Okay, I distracted you though. So you were saying a little bit sad.
Oh yeah, that's all. I was just thinking like, there's like something else. My 9-year-old's coming down that
cool,
like colors the movie in a different way that makes it like more meaningful.
What about like, oh my God, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original.
Oh, that's such a good movie.
That I've seen that one time and I could barely watch it.
I think I've only seen it once.
I cannot handle it.
And the other thing I was going to say, because my children are now coming down the stairs, is Alex and I recorded this during the day, everyone.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reading Ann Yoder's The Enhancers.
Oh, yes.
It's incredible.
I'm really excited to read it.
Truly its own thing.
She's coming on.
Man, I thought she might be.
Mommy, look.
I think I have her on the schedule.
Yay. Okay, good. Ann Yoder's coming on, everyone. Go get The Enhancers so you're ready.
Shout out Meekling Press.
What up, Meekling? They sent me a really cute little, like tiny little, like handmade book about a cat when I ordered this book. So everyone, and a nice bookmark.
I gotta order it.
So there you go.
There you go.
All right. Go enjoy your Sunday.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
Okay.
I'm a Writer But is recorded by Alex Higley and me, Lindsay Hunter, in our respective basements. Editing by Lindsay Hunter. Music by Max Loop.
Yeah!